underwent a significant organizational change. At the behest of the State War Navy Coordinating Committee, control over the program was removed from the Military Intelligence Division of the War Department, G2, and given over to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The newly created Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, JOA, would now be in charge of decision-making for the rapidly expanding classified program. The JOA was a subcommittee of the Joint Intelligence Committee, which provided national security information to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. To understand the JOA's power and how it ran the Nazi scientist program so secretively is to first understand the nature of the Joint Intelligence Committee. According to national security historian Larry A. Valero, who has written a monograph on the subject for the CIA, the JIC was and remains one of the most enigmatic of all the American intelligence agencies. The JIC structure was always in motion, always morphing and changing, a flexible ad hoc system, Valero says. Subcommittees came and went, so did staff officers, but JIC decisions always had to be by consensus and were always reported to the Joint Chiefs. Little has been written about the inner workings of the JOA, but the stories of individual Nazi scientists and the JOA's trail of partially declassified papers help to define this powerful post-war organization. In the immediate aftermath of the German surrender, the Joint Intelligence Committee was focused on the emerging Soviet threat. Between June 15, 1945, and August 9, 1945, the JIC wrote and delivered 16 major intelligence reports and 27 policy papers to the Joint Chiefs. The most important JIC estimates involved the military capabilities and future intentions of the USSR, says Valero. Those intelligence estimates determined that the Soviets were ideologically hostile to the West and would continue to seek global domination, an attitude they had managed to skillfully conceal during the war. In September 1945, the JIC advised the Joint Chiefs that the Soviet Union would postpone open conflict with the West in the immediate future, but only so it could rebuild its military arsenal and by 1952 be back at fighting strength. After this date, said the JIC, the Soviets would be ready and able to engage the United States in total war. The following month, JIC Intelligence Report 250-4, the fourth report in the JIC 250 series, warned the Joint Chiefs that 8 out of 10 leading German scientists in the field of guided missiles had recently gone missing from Germany, had most likely been captured by the Soviets, and were now at work in the USSR. Similarly threatening, noted the report, two German physics institutes had been seized by the Red Army and reassembled in the USSR. Not just the laboratories and the libraries, but the scientists as well. JIC 250-4 warned of intensive Soviet scientific research programs underway across Russia, all of which threatened the West. It was from within this environment of intense suspicion that the JOA was created. The Nazi scientist program was an aggressive U.S. military program from the moment the JOA took control, just a few weeks after two atomic bombs ended the war with Japan. The employment of German scientists was specifically and strategically aimed at achieving military supremacy over the Soviet Union before the Soviet Union was able to dominate the United States. Attaining supreme military power meant marshaling all the cutting-edge science and technology that could be culled from the ruins of the Reich. In the eyes of military intelligence, the fact that the scientists happened to be Nazis was incidental, a troublesome detail. It had no bearing on the bigger plan. The clock was ticking, and, according to the Joint Intelligence Committee, would likely run out sometime around 1952. There was language in the existing Nazi scientist policy that now had to be dealt with by the JOA. The phrase, "no known or alleged war criminal," could not remain as part of policy nomenclature for long, nor could the phrase, "no ardent Nazis." These words had been put there to appease a few generals in the Pentagon, certain individuals in the State Department, and moralists like Dr. H.P. Robertson, General Eisenhower's chief of scientific intelligence. For the program to move forward according to this new strategy, the language needed to change. With the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency now in control, a new, aggressive recruitment process would begin. On its governing body, the JOA had one representative of each member agency of the Joint Intelligence Committee, the Army's Director of Intelligence, the Chief of Naval Intelligence, the Assistant Chief of Air Staff II, Air Force Intelligence, and a representative from the State Department. The diplomat in the group was outnumbered by the military officers 3-1. The State Department officer assigned to the JOA was Samuel Klaus, and he was perceived by his JOA colleagues to be a troublemaker from day one. Samuel Klaus was a 42-year-old shining star in the State Department, a brilliant lawyer, avid horseman, and Hebrew scholar who also spoke Russian and German. Because Klaus was the man on the JOA who was in charge of approving the visas for all incoming German scientists, it was important that he be on board with what the JOA wanted to accomplish. But Samuel Klaus was fundamentally opposed to the Nazi scientist program, and this created intense conflict within the JOA. Klaus had hands-on experience with Nazi Party ideology, owing to his wartime work for the U.S. Foreign Economic Administration during the war. During the war, Klaus ran Operation Safe Haven, a program with international reach designed to capture Nazi assets, including stolen art and gold, being smuggled out of Germany for safekeeping in neutral countries. During his years running Safe Haven, Klaus had interviewed hundreds of German civilians, and he had developed the belief that many ordinary Germans had profited from the Nazi Party and had had a tacit understanding of what was happening to the Jews. In his role as the State Department representative on the JOA, Klaus argued that the Germans at issue were not brilliant scientists who had been unwittingly caught in a maelstrom of evil, but rather that they were amoral opportunists of mediocre talent. JOA records indicate that Klaus's sentiments were shared by at least two of his State Department colleagues, including Herbert Cummings and Howard Travers. But it was Samuel Klaus who was unabashedly vocal about how he felt and what he believed. At a JOA meeting in the late fall of 1945, Klaus vowed that less than a dozen German scientists would ever be permitted to enter the U.S. on his watch. For this, he was seen as a thorn in the side of military intelligence, and he was also outnumbered. Per the JOA's charter, it was required to share its plan with a cabinet-level advisory board, which included a representative from the Department of Commerce. As it so happened, the representative from the Commerce Department, John C. Green, was an advocate of the German scientist program, apparently without benefit of knowing who these German scientists really were. In the fall of 1945, Green came up with an idea that would undermine Samuel Klaus's resistance to Operation Overcast. After the war in Europe ended, President Truman put the Department of Commerce in charge of a program designed to excite the nation about a unique form of reparations being culled from the defeated German state, namely the acquisition of scientific and technical information. There would be no financial compensation coming from Nazi Germany, the Department of Commerce explained, but American industry could now benefit from a different kind of restitution, knowledge. Secretary of Commerce and former Vice President Henry Wallace had been appointed by the president to supervise the release of thousands of what would become known as PB reports, named after the Commerce Department's Office of the Publication Board. These reports contained non-armaments-related information collected by SIOS officers in Germany after the war. The idea behind the PB reports was to get average Americans to start their own small businesses inspired by German technological advances. These new businesses would be a boon to America's post-war prosperity, the Commerce Department said. Thanks to Reich scientists, the public was told, beverage manufacturers could now sterilize fruit juice without heat. Women could enjoy run-proof hosiery. Butter could be churned at the rate of 1,500 pounds per hour. These lists seem not to end. Yeast could be produced in unlimited quantities, and wool could be pulled from sheepskins without injuring the animal's hide. All because of brilliant German scientists. Hitler's wizards had reduced suitcase-sized electrical components to the size of a pinky finger and pioneered electromagnetic tape. Henry Wallace was one of the nation's greatest champions of the idea that Americans could find prosperity thanks to science. Wallace had served under Roosevelt in 1944, when Roosevelt promised Americans 60 million jobs. The promise became the subject of a book by Wallace, 60 Million Jobs. As Secretary of Commerce, he intended to make good on it. Business, industry, and government could work together to make the world prosperous in peace, Wallace said. German science was a jumping-off point. The public was not made aware of a second list regarding captured German scientific and technical information, one marked classified. This list cataloged 1,800 reports on German technology with military potential. Subject headings included rockets, chemical warfare, medical practice, aeronautics, ordnance, insecticides, and physics, nuclear. The man in charge of both lists, the classified and the unclassified one, was Henry Wallace's executive secretary and his representative on the JOA, John C. Green. Regarding the classified list, Green got an idea. Peace and prosperity were, in principle, sound ideas. But there was big business in war. Green wanted to make the classified list available to certain groups in industry. Specialized knowledge should not be locked up in the minds of German scientists and technicians, Green said. It needed to be shared. To help foster this sharing, in the fall of 1945, John C. Green traveled to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, to meet with Colonel Donald Putt. The first group of six Germans brought to Wright Field in the fall of 1945 lived in an isolated and secure housing area called the Hilltop, a cluster of five single-story wooden buildings and three small cottages that had once housed the National Youth Administration. Almost no one but the program's administrators knew that the German scientists were there. There was a single-lane dirt road that passed by the Hilltop, used only by locals who needed to visit the town dump. Trucks and station wagons filled with trash sped by the Hilltop's secret inhabitants, and when it rained, the road turned into a sea of mud. This annoyed the Germans, and they began compiling a list of grievances to share with Colonel Putt at a later date. They knew better than to complain just yet. Considering the fate and circumstances of many of their colleagues back in Germany, theirs was a particularly good deal. But when the timing was right, they would share this list of indignities, which would in turn affect the Nazi scientist program in the most unusual way. The original scientists at Wright Field were listed as Dr. Gerhard Braun, motor research, Dr. Theodore Zobel, aerodynamics, and Dr. Rudolf Edz, rocket fuels. The specialists were Mr. Otto Bock, supersonics, Mr. Heinz Richter, aerodynamics, and Mr. Albert Patin, a businessman. Their salaries average $12,480 a year, plus a $6 per diem, the equivalent of about $175,000 in 2013. Because of an oversight, later caught and corrected, the Germans did not pay U.S. taxes for the first 2 years and 20 months of the program. At the Hilltop, a husband and wife team of housekeepers looked after the Germans' domestic needs, washed their laundry, and made their beds. German prisoners of war who had already been brought to the United States and were not yet repatriated acted as cooks. The six scientists and specialists, and the others who would soon follow, carried military-issue identification cards that had a large green S stamped on the front, indicating that they were not allowed to leave the base on their own. A gate running around the perimeter of the Hilltop was to be locked from 5 p.m. to 7 a.m. each night. On weekends, U.S. Army intelligence officers escorted the Germans into Dayton, where they could exercise at the local YMCA. A priest was brought in from Cincinnati to deliver Sunday Mass in German. "We would like you to know and to appreciate that you are here in the interest of science, and we hope that you will work with us in close harmony to further develop and expand your various subjects of interest," read the introductory pamphlet issued to each specialist at Wright Field. "We have tried to make you comfortable in the quarters assigned to you." What the Germans craved most was respect, and this eluded them. During the war, Hitler's scientists and industrialists had been treated with great admiration by the Reich. Most scientists enjoyed financial reward. But here at Wright Field, many of the Germans' American counterparts looked down on them with disdain. The mere mention of a German scientist is enough to precipitate emotions in Air Corps personnel, ranging from vehemence to frustration, one manager stated in an official classified report. As commanding general for intelligence at Wright Field, Colonel Donald Putt was in charge of the German specialist program. Putt had great admiration for each of the scientists, having hand-picked almost every one of them in Germany at the Hermann Göring Aeronautical Research Center at Völkenrode and elsewhere. He could not fathom why the specialists were looked upon with contempt. "All they wanted was an opportunity to work," Putt said. Colonel Putt's vision for the Germans' workload in America was threefold. Initially, he planned for the men to write reports on their past and future work. Next, those reports would be translated and circulated among American engineers at Wright Field. Then, Air Technical Service Command would hold research and development seminars at Wright Field, with invitations sent out to defense contractors, university laboratories, and any other interested parties with top-secret clearance and a contract with the Army Air Forces. But Putt's idea came to a grinding halt after the War Department weighed in on his proposal, responding to what it called calculated risk. The German scientist program was a highly classified military program and needed to remain secret. A War Department memo required that the Germans remain properly segregated from persons not directly concerned with their exploitation. There was to be no fraternizing with American scientists. Collaboration with defense contractors and others was impossible at this point in the program. The German specialists were offended by the way they were treated. Word from Dr. Herbert Wagner, inventor of the HS-293 missile, was that Gould Castle on Long Island, where Wagner resided and worked, had marble bathtubs. Naval intelligence allowed their German scientists to take field trips into Manhattan. The Germans at Wright Field told Putt they felt like caged animals, and they demanded that something be done about it. Putt saw opportunity here. He wrote to Army Intelligence G2 to say that the Germans' overall malaise was critically affecting their ability to work. When the Pentagon ignored Putt's concerns, he appealed to Major Hugh Knair, his commanding general at Air Technical Service Command. Knair wrote to the Pentagon, "Intangibles of a scientist's daily life directly affect the quality of his product," he said, but this too had little effect. In Washington, the general feeling was that Operation Overcast was temporary and that the Germans should be happy to have jobs. Besides, the Nuremberg trials were about to begin. On October 18, 1945, an indictment was lodged by the International Military Tribunal against the defendants named as major war criminals. The trial would take place inside the East Wing of the Nuremberg Palace of Justice, with opening statements beginning November 20th. Because this was a military tribunal, sentences would be passed by judges, not jurors. Nuremberg as a city had played a unique role in the rise of the Nazi Party. It had been the site of Hitler's Nazi Party rallies, colossal military parades supported by as many as 400,000 Nazi loyalists, and home to the Nuremberg race laws. Now, the leaders in the regime would be tried in this location for conspiracy, crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. As the trial began, 21 defendants sat crammed onto two benches inside courtroom 600, headphones over their ears. There were 22 defendants. Martin Bormann was tried in absentia. Behind them, on a wall, symbolically positioned over their heads, was a large marble statue of the hideous monster Medusa. The 21 present faced the death penalty if convicted. "The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating," Chief U.S. Prosecutor Justice Robert H. Jackson famously declared, "that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated." The trial would last almost a year, with stories about Nuremberg and the Nazi war crimes dominating world news. Complaints about comfort from the Germans at Wright Field meant very little to the War Department general staff. The same month the Nuremberg trial opened, in October 1945, the Army Air Forces hosted a grand 2-day-long fair at Wright Field. On display were captured German and Japanese aircraft and rockets seen by the public for the first time since war's end. Over 500,000 people from 26 countries came to marvel at the confiscated enemy equipment, said to be worth $150 million. Among the items on display were the V-2 rocket, the Fokker Wulf FW-190 G-3 fighter aircraft, and the Messerschmitt ME-262. Particularly fascinating to the public was that some of the airplanes still had swastikas painted on their tails. The fair was so popular that the Army Air Forces extended it for 5 days. There was no mention made of the fact that several of the men who had designed and engineered these weapons were living a stone's throw away at the hilltop. Among the 500,000 visitors at the fair was John C. Green, the Commerce Department's representative on the JOA Advisory Board and its executive secretary overseeing the PB reports. The board had just changed its name to the Office of Technical Services, underscoring its transformation from a passive board to a more active service that would make use of cutting-edge science and technology. As planned, Green tracked down Colonel Putt at the Wright Field Fair. He had a myriad of questions for Putt, all of which centered around one idea. How could all this science and technology on display benefit American industry moving forward? Initially, Putt was uneasy about Green's attention, but in the end, he decided to take a gamble on him. After all, John C. Green had access to the classified list. Putt shared with him some information about the German scientists on the hilltop. How they were like men kept in an ivory tower. How their talents were squandered by policy and prejudice in some circles in Washington, D.C. They needed employment opportunities, Putt lamented. Perhaps Green could help. Green seemed amenable, and Putt took note. During his visit to the Air Force's fair, Wright Field, John C. Green evidenced keen interest and inquired as to the reaction of industry toward the possible employment of German scientists, Putt wrote in a memo. He was not yet clear if Green's influence is favorable or unfavorable, but Putt decided to take the risk. He forwarded to Green several letters of interest from defense contractors regarding potential employment of the German scientists. These documents had already been received by Air Materiel Command. They included letters from Dow Chemical Company, the Air Research Manufacturing Company, and the Aircraft Industries Association. Defense contracts meant that there was business in the wings waiting to be transacted. It was Washington, D.C. that stood in the way. Putt explained to Green that these private businesses did not have a high enough security clearance to deal directly with the German scientists themselves. John C. Green wrote to Joa explaining what he had in mind. German scientists of international repute should be allowed, with their families, to enter the United States for long-term work, argued Green. This was good for American businesses. The letters from the defense contractors indicated that there was a great demand for this kind of work. The Commerce Department would set up a board to weed out the Nazis and bring the good Germans in. The German scientists' knowledge and know-how would be fully and freely available to all Americans, said Green. This boom to industry would help create tens of thousands of American jobs. Inside the JOA, reactions were mixed, particularly among advisory board members. The Assistant Secretary of the Interior was skeptical as to how Commerce could guarantee to keep old Nazis out of the program. The War Department did not like the idea of having to bring the families to America. Army Intelligence felt Green's proposal had validity from an economic perspective. If Commerce got involved in the German scientist program, the Army would not necessarily have to shoulder so much of the financial burden. The State Department continued to voice objections, saying that regardless of who footed the bill, visas were not going to be granted to former enemies of the state without thorough and individual investigations. The Nazi scientist program was a temporary military program, State said, nothing more. John C. Green had an alternative plan. Instead of arguing his case further to the JOA advisory board, he appealed to his boss, Henry Wallace. In turn, Henry Wallace wrote directly to President Truman, requesting that the president support the German science program. Science would help create those 60 million jobs, Wallace said, and nothing had a higher national priority in peacetime than American jobs. It was wise and logical to bring to America scientists of outstanding attainments who can make a positive contribution to our scientific and industrial efforts, Wallace wrote to President Truman on December 4, 1945. The knowledge these men possessed, Wallace said, if added to our own, would advance the frontiers of scientific knowledge for national benefit. To illustrate his point, Wallace used one of the most benign scientists in all of Germany, a concrete and road construction expert named Dr. O. Graf, who had helped design the Autobahn. If you agree that the importance of a selected few, approximately 50 in number, would be an asset to our economy, I suggest you declare that this to be U.S. policy, Wallace urged the president. For Colonel Donald Putt at Wright Field and the military intelligence members of the JOA, Henry Wallace's endorsement of the program was like a shot in the arm. Before Wallace's letter to the president, Samuel Klaus of the State Department had suggested that the public would be outraged by the program once they found out about it. It could not stay secret forever, nor was it meant to. Klaus had said that bringing Hitler's former scientists to America for Weapons Research and Development, gave the impression that the Army and the Navy were willing to make deals with the devil for national security gains. Henry Wallace's economically-minded endorsement changed all that. It gave the German scientist program an air of democracy, offering counterbalance to what could be perceived as an aggressive military program. Henry Wallace had been staunchly anti-Nazi during the war. Preceding Truman in the vice presidency, Wallace had publicly called Hitler a supreme devil operating through a human form. In another famous speech, he'd likened Hitler to Satan 7 times. That Henry Wallace was encouraging President Truman to endorse the German scientist program in the name of economic prosperity gave Operation Overcast a future. Henry Wallace was exactly what the Joa had been waiting for. On November 4, 1945, a headline in the Washington Post caught the nation's attention. Army uncovers lurid Nazi science of freezing men. The article, written by reporter George Connery, was a major news scoop. In an effort to garner support for subsequent military trials in Nuremberg, the War Department had leaked to Connery the secret PSYOS report written by war crimes investigator Dr. Leo Alexander. The report chronicled the freezing experiments conducted at Dachau inside Experimental Cell Block 5. That human beings had been tortured to death by German physicians in the name of medical science was both horrifying and incomprehensible to most Americans. The Post article revealed that the only man believed to have survived the freezing experiments had been located by Dr. Leo Alexander. Most of the other victims, the so-called Untermenschen, whom the Nazi doctors had experimented on, died in the process or were killed. It was likely that this sole surviving victim, a Catholic priest, would provide witness testimony in the Nuremberg courts. Americans were rapt. Kept secret from the public was an astonishing hypocrisy. Less than 150 miles from the Nuremberg courtroom, several of the physicians who had participated in, and many others who were accessory to, these criminal medical experiments were now being employed by the U.S. Army at the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center, the classified research facility in Heidelberg. This laboratory, dreamed up by Colonel Harry Armstrong and Major General Malcolm Groh at a meeting in France in the spring of 1945, would remain one of the best-kept secrets of Operation Paperclip for decades to come. Here, starting on September 20, 1945, 58 doctors, handpicked by Dr. Strughold, had been working on medical research projects begun for the Third Reich. Some of the data the Nazi doctors were using in their new army research had been obtained in experiments in which test subjects had been murdered. For Groh and Armstrong, the plan was to have these Luftwaffe doctors reconfigure the results of their war work in Heidelberg under army supervision. The follow-on plan was for these doctors to come to the United States under paperclip contracts. Because conducting military research inside Germany was a violation of Allied Control Council Law 25 of the Potsdam Accord, the Aeromedical Center's classified nature shielded the Nazi doctors from chance exposure. The co-directors of this secret research facility, Colonel Harry Armstrong and Dr. Hubertus Strughold, were alike in many ways, so much so that some saw the two men as mirror images of one another. The growing success of the Aeromedical Center would prove to be a launching point for each man's meteoric post-war career. Armstrong would eventually be promoted to U.S. Surgeon General of the Air Force. Strughold would become the father of U.S. space medicine. Harry Armstrong, born in 1899, entered into the U.S. military when horses were still being ridden into battle. During World War I, Armstrong learned how to drive a six-mule ambulance and decided to become a doctor. After receiving his medical degree from the University of Louisville, he opened a private practice in Minneapolis. He might have become a country doctor, but he was preoccupied by airplanes and dirigibles. Appointed first lieutenant in the Medical Corps Reserve, Armstrong entered the School of Aviation Medicine, SAM, at Brooks Field in San Antonio, Texas, in 1924. In 1925, he decided to specialize in a field of medicine few had ever heard of, and soon he would become a flight surgeon. He had never flown in an airplane before. It was a master sergeant named Irwin H. Nichols who inspired Armstrong to make his first parachute jump. In a lecture that took place in a parachute hangar, Nichols presented the idea that one day, entire troops of infantrymen just might jump out of airplanes into combat situations as a group. After the class was over, Armstrong got in a long conversation with Nichols. He told me that he was puzzled by the fact that people who he supervised in practice jumps almost invariably failed to follow his instruction, which was to count 10 after leaving the airplane before pulling the ripcord, Armstrong explained. He said that Nichols feared jumpers would black out or get into a panic and pull the ripcord too quickly. When Nichols hinted that he would be very happy if some doctor would make the jump to see if they could solve his problem, Armstrong's mind was made up. I decided I would make a practice jump and delay my opening as long as possible. A few weeks later, Armstrong was standing in the cockpit of a biplane, wearing a flying suit and a gabardine helmet and getting ready to jump. I had a feeling of panic, Armstrong explained, but he hurled himself out of the aircraft anyway. As he fell through the air, he kept his eyes closed and paid particular attention to what his body felt like as he descended. The feeling of panic disappeared, he later recalled. He did not lose consciousness or black out. Armstrong allowed himself to free fall for approximately 1,200 feet before he finally pulled the ripcord. His parachute opened and he floated the last 1,000 feet to Earth, where he landed in a grassy Texas field. Harry Armstrong had set a U.S. Army record. He was the first flight surgeon to make a free fall from an aircraft. Armstrong finished school and returned to Minnesota, but with an insatiable love of flying. On March 21, 1930, he closed his practice in Minneapolis and joined the Army for good. His life as one of the most important figures in the history of American aviation and aerospace medicine had begun. When Armstrong arrived with his family at Wright Field in 1934, the world was enamored with airplanes, which were not yet so associated with war, but with peacetime progress and the spirit of adventure. Jimmy Doolittle set a transcontinental record flying from California to New Jersey in 11 hours, 16 minutes. Wiley Post and Harold Gaddy circled the globe in 8 days. At Wright Field, the primary task of the flight surgeon was determining who was physically fit to fly in the airplanes of the day. Armstrong was a man with a vision, and he was also a soldier. He envisioned a future where wars would be fought in the air. The Army Air Corps' most advanced fighter aircraft was a biplane with a speed of around 200 miles per hour and a flight ceiling of 18,000 feet. Armstrong's work centered around resolving problems related to oxygen deprivation and exposure to cold. One day, Armstrong spotted a trapdoor in the floor of his office inside Building 16 at Wright Field. He opened the door, saw a staircase, and climbed down. He found himself in a basement filled with old machinery and drafting tables. An unusual-looking chamber, like something out of a novel by Jules Verne, caught his eye. It was shaped like a globe, made of iron, and had windows like submarine portholes. This was the Army's first and only low-pressure chamber, built decades earlier for its World War I flight surgeon school. The school, located in Mineola, Long Island, had closed down after the war, and the chamber had wound up here at Wright Field. Armstrong got an idea. Next door to his office, Army Air Force's engineers were designing airplanes that could fly faster, higher, and farther than ever before. Armstrong wanted to begin research and development on the medical effects that flying these new airplanes would have on pilots. He wrote a letter to the engineering division at Wright Field requesting permission. The letter was forwarded to Washington. In no time, Armstrong was appointed director of the Physiological Research Unit, later called the Aeromedical Research Laboratory and other variations on the name, at Wright Field. His lab took off. Shop mechanics built test chambers from old airplane parts. He hired a scientist from Harvard, a PhD named John Bill Heim. Using volunteer test subjects, Heim and Armstrong gathered data on how the body responds to speed, lower oxygen levels, and decompression sickness and extreme temperatures. But it was an experiment on himself, with a rabbit on his lap, for which Armstrong became legendary. He had been wondering what really happened to the human body above 10,000 feet. Why and at what specific height would a man die? Armstrong climbed into the low-pressure chamber with the rabbit on his lap. His technician adjusted the pressure to simulate high altitude. Armstrong's chest began to tighten and his joints hurt. When he rubbed his hands, he felt tiny bubbles along his tendons, ones that he could move around under his skin. He surmised that these were nitrogen bubbles forming in his blood and tissues, and that death at high altitude was caused by blood clotting. Armstrong indicated to the technician that he should simulate an even higher altitude inside the chamber. He was wearing an oxygen mask, but the rabbit on his lap was not. Soon, the rabbit would be dead. As the lab technician raised the pressure, the rabbit convulsed and died. When Armstrong got out of the chamber, he dissected the rabbit and found nitrogen bubbles, proving that his hypothesis was correct. Armstrong's discovery gave way to a major milestone in aviation medicine. Working with Heim on more tests, he inserted a viewing tube into the artery of a test animal. The two men took data on what happens to a mammal's body at 40,000, 50,000, and finally 65,000 feet. They were the first to witness that body fluids boil at 63,000 feet. This point would become known as the Armstrong line. This is the altitude beyond which humans cannot survive without a pressure suit. In 1937, Captain Harry Armstrong was considered one of America's aviation medicine pioneers. On October 2nd of that year, he attended the Aeromedical Association's first international convention, which took place in the Astor Gallery of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. There, he and Heim reported the results of their recent studies at Wright Field. One of the doctors most interested in these studies was the Luftwaffe physician representing Germany, Dr. Hubertus Strughold. The two men, Armstrong and Strughold, were pioneers in the same field. "We hit it off immediately," remembered Harry Armstrong decades later. That fortuitous meeting would profoundly shape Strughold's post-Nazi career. Some men claim to be shaped by a single event. For Hubertus Strughold, it was watching Halley's Comet streak across the sky from his backyard treehouse in Westtunen, Germany, in 1910. "Forever after," said Strughold, "he became preoccupied with what lies above." That same year, a second event shaped the rest of his life. Strughold watched a solar eclipse through a viewing glass and nearly went blind. The lens wasn't as dark as he thought it was, and he burned the retina of his right eye, causing permanent damage. When I looked at somebody with the right eye, at his nose, he had no nose. When I looked at somebody at the street, at a distance of about 100 meters, at somebody's head, with the right eye, he did not have a head. It was always clear with both eyes, Strughold later explained. Hubertus Strughold had learned the hard way that experiments using one's own body could be dangerous. Still, as a young man, he pursued auto-experimentation with vigor and imagination. In college, he studied physics, anatomy, and zoology, but it was physiology that interested him most, the function of living organisms and their parts. At the University of Würzburg, Strughold taught the world's first college course on the effects high altitude had on the human body. His experimental test data came from himself. On weekends, he flew hot air balloons, recording everything from vision to ear pressure to muscle effects. Inside the flying balloon, Professor Strughold recorded how his body responded to rapid acceleration and descent, which in turn made him curious to know how he would feel during radical banking turns. For that, he needed an airplane. Strughold found the perfect mentor in a World War I flying ace by the name of Robert Ritter von Grimm. Von Grimm was a legend, renowned for his fearlessness in battle. In World War I, he had recorded 28 kills. In the 1920s and 1930s, he was considered one of the top pilots in Germany and performed a variety of flight-related jobs, including exhibition dogfights against fellow World War I flying ace Ernst Udet. When Adolf Hitler needed a pilot to fly him from Munich to Berlin for the Kapp-Pusch coup attempt in 1920, he chose Robert Ritter von Grimm for the job. In 1926, von Grimm was hired by Chiang Kai-shek to set up the Chinese Air Force in Canton, China. Returning to Germany, von Grimm opened a flight school located at the top of a mountain in Galgenberg, 2 miles from where Hubertus Strughold taught aviation medicine to college students. Strughold hired von Grimm to teach him how to fly, paying him 6 marks per lesson. The two men became fast friends. In Robert Ritter von Grimm, Hubertus Strughold found a brilliant match, another man willing to push pilot performance to the edge of unconsciousness. The men would strap themselves into harnesses in von Grimm's open cockpit airplane and fly loops and rolls in the skies over Galgenberg. Strughold kept track of their physiological reactions to extreme flight, seeking answers to questions. Can a man draw a straight line while flying upside down? Can a pilot mark a bullseye on a piece of paper immediately after a barrel roll? With how little oxygen could a man legibly write his name? How far up can a man fly before his vision fades? Von Grimm was challenged by Strughold's strange requests, and he was willing to fly faster and higher as his new young physician friend recorded data on von Grimm's pilot performance and physical capabilities in the air. Strughold knew his tests were original and hoped they would attract interest from the United States. In 1928, his wish came true when he received a prestigious fellowship from the Rockefeller Foundation. Strughold packed his bags, boarded the SS Dresden, and headed to New York. Hubertus Strughold took to America like a fish to water, he later explained. As a Rockefeller Foundation fellow at the University of Chicago, he was at the center of the music scene in the Roaring Twenties. Listening to jazz music was his favorite pastime after flying. In Chicago, he attended vaudeville shows, parties, and dances, and became fluent in English. He loved to drink and almost always smoked. His thick German accent distinguished him from everyone else around and made most people remember him. His first scientific paper in English was on oxygen deficiency and how to revive a heart using electric shock. For research, he used dogs as test subjects, importing them from Canada at a time when experimenting on dogs from the United States was illegal. Strughold attended conferences in Boston and visited the laboratories at Harvard, at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, and at Columbia University in New York. And he met and became friendly with American aviation medicine pioneers like Harry Armstrong. The Rockefeller Fellowship lasted only a year. Back in Germany, Strughold and von Grime took up where they left off. Von Grime was now flying a double-decker Uday Flamingo aircraft, an aerobatic sports biplane made of wood. To determine how many G-forces a man could take before his eyeballs suffered damage, the two men would climb high in the air, then dive down toward the ground until one of them blacked out. Von Grime's longtime friend and colleague, Adolf Hitler, took power in 1933. In secret, von Grime was called upon by Hermann Göring to rebuild the German Air Force, in violation of the Treaty of Versailles. Through his personal friendship with von Grime, Strughold ingratiated himself into this inner circle of Nazi power. In 1935, he was offered a job that would shape the rest of his life. As director of the Aviation Medical Research Institute of the Reich Air Ministry in Berlin, he was now in the uppermost echelon of Luftwaffe medical research. The lab, located in the suburb of Charlottenburg, featured a state-of-the-art low-pressure chamber and a 10-foot centrifuge in which test subjects could be exposed to varying degrees of gravitational pull. The chamber could take both apes and humans to between 15 and 20 Gs. The job required time, commitment, and most of all, dedication. The Reich needed the Luftwaffe to help conquer all of Europe. This was why Strughold had packed his bags and moved to Berlin. He would report directly to Erich Hipke, chief of the Luftwaffe's medical corps, who reported to Hermann Göring. This was a vertical career move for Strughold. He'd gone from a university teaching post to the top of the Reich's aviation medicine chain of command. The Reich had vast resources and a desire to conduct groundbreaking experiments for the benefit of its pilots. There were risks, but with risks came rewards. For Strughold, the reward was monumental. For 10 years, he enjoyed a career as one of the most powerful physicians working for the Third Reich. In Berlin, Strughold treated his expansive new laboratory as a haven for risk-takers. Colleagues, including officials from the Nazi Party and the SS, would stop by to marvel over his work with the low-pressure chamber and the centrifuge. Experiments were almost always in progress. Strughold's medical assistants were forever allowing themselves to be hooked up to these odd-looking contraptions with pipes, valves, and hoses projecting from all sides. Assistants, one with and one without an oxygen mask, would allow themselves to be locked inside the low-pressure chamber in order to determine how high up a man could go before becoming unconscious. During one experiment, two officials with the Reich Air Ministry were on hand to observe. The man without the oxygen mask began to lose consciousness. First, his eyes closed, then his head fell to his chest. The second man inside the chamber, wearing a mask, administered first aid. It did not take long for the man to quickly recover. "Our studies are all very risky," Strughold told the Nazi Party officials. "They require great ability on the part of the assistants and great responsibility. If the man did not get oxygen, he might be dead in 5 minutes." As the Luftwaffe prepared its pilots for war, Strughold continued to use his staff as test subjects. He also experimented on himself. He was said to have ridden the centrifuge for a full 2 minutes, simulating what it would be like to experience 15 times the force of gravity while flying an airplane. After Germany invaded Poland in September 1939, the war spread into areas of extreme climates, from Norway to North Africa to the Russian front. These new combat theaters created urgent new medical problems for the Reich, most notably for foot soldiers, but also for the Luftwaffe. As the war progressed and the Luftwaffe unveiled one new airplane after the next, the pilot physiology challenges grew. By 1940, new engine systems were being developed, including turbo and jet engines, with countless pilot parameters to explore, including the effects of speed, lower oxygen levels, decompression sickness, and extreme temperatures on the body. A web of institutions sprang up across Germany and its newly conquered lands, all financed by the deep pockets of the Reich Research Council, and including Strughold's Aviation Medical Research Institute in Berlin. The institute worked hand in hand with two Luftwaffe facilities close by, and Strughold developed strong relationships with the director of each institute, Dr. Theodor Benzinger of the experimental station of the Air Force Research Center at Raeklin, and Dr. Siegfried Ruff of the German Experimental Station for Aviation Medicine, Aeromedical Division, in Berlin. This is why, after the war, when Strughold was asked by Colonel Armstrong to be the co-director of the classified AAF Aeromedical Facility in Heidelberg, Strughold asked Benzinger and Ruff to come along. He put each man in charge of one of the four areas of aviation research at the new facility. They trusted one another. They all had the same secrets to protect. Dr. Theodor Benzinger was tall, thin as a rail, 5'11" and just 138 pounds. He had dark blue eyes, sharp, angular features, and kept his black hair slicked back with a pencil part. Born in 1905, Benzinger was described in his Army intelligence dossier as an old-school Prussian, willful, self-serving, and willing to get what he wants by any means. At Heidelberg, he was put in charge of a department that developed oxygen equipment for airplanes. Benzinger was a committed Nazi and had been from the earliest days of National Socialism. He joined the Nazi Party the year Hitler took power, in 1933. He was also a member of the SA, holding the position of Medical Sergeant Major. He and his wife, Ilse Benzinger, were members of the NSV, the Nazi Party's so-called social welfare organization, which was overseen by Reich Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels. Ilse was active in NSV-sponsored programs like Mother and Child, whereby unwed German mothers could birth Aryan children on bucolic baby farms. In 1934, the 29-year-old Dr. Benzinger was made department chief of the experimental station of the Air Force Research Center. Like Harry Armstrong, Benzinger predicted that pilots would fly high-altitude missions to 60,000 feet sometime in the near future. In service of this idea, Benzinger and his staff at Raeklin researched high-altitude durability and explosive decompression. They took great risks experimenting on themselves. On one occasion, one of Benzinger's technicians died as a result of complications from oxygen deprivation experienced inside a low-pressure chamber. In addition to researching aviation medicine, Benzinger became a pilot and served as a colonel in the Luftwaffe. He flew reconnaissance and combat missions over the British Isles. In 1939, showing bravery before the enemy, Benzinger was awarded the Iron Cross, Class 1 and Class 2. In Heidelberg, at the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center, Strughold put Dr. Siegfried Ruf in charge of work involving the effect G-forces have on human beings. This was work that Ruf had begun at the test center in Raeklin with Dr. Benziger during the war. Ruf did not have the same